So here we are at the end of Titus, the last piece of the letter. And at this point, we're past the high point of the letter, right? The high point of the letter, as I read it, was really the last 2 weeks that we looked at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3, the two sermons that we kind of entitled Heavenly Homeways. So at this point, we're past that. We're on to the off-ramp, you could say, as Paul wraps up some practical concerns, makes some last few points, and then sticks in that one last summary of what's on his heart as he thinks of the churches in Crete. So we'll read it, and then we'll just jump right into it. This is Titus chapter 3, from verse 9 to the end of the chapter. But avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and arguments and quarrels about the law, because these are unprofitable and useless. Warn a divisive person once and then warn him a second time. After that, have nothing to do with him. You may be sure that such a man is warped and sinful. He is self-condemned. As soon as I send Artemis or Tychicus to you, do your best to come to me at Nicopolis, because I have decided to winter there. Do everything you can to help Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way, and see that they have everything they need. Our people must learn to devote themselves to doing what is good, in order that they may provide for daily necessities and not live unproductive lives. Everyone with me sends you greetings. Greet those who love us in the faith. Grace be with you all. The word of God for the people of God. Okay, so first, kind of the other stuff, right? The incidental stuff that Paul mentions here that is helpful in kind of piecing together what the situation that all of Paul's letters were written in, right? So first of all, either Artemis, right, or a guy named Tychicus. Artemis, we basically, there's no other mentions of him. Tychicus is mentioned a couple times as someone who carried several of Paul's letters. He says that one of them will soon show up in Crete in order to take over for Titus, so that Titus would be freed up to rejoin Paul. Nicopolis, where Paul was, is on the west coast of Greece. So we know at that point, like as you get 1 Timothy, Titus, 2 Timothy, that Paul was working in that part and then ends up going kind of north there into an area called Dalmatia. So Paul was working there, and we've seen at the introduction of the letter, when I talked a little bit about who Titus was, that Titus was one of Paul's absolute closest workers. You know, the only one that you can rank with Titus is probably Timothy himself. And so Paul needed him back. We see in 2 Timothy, which is probably about a year after Titus, not that long, maybe a little more than a year, that at the time of 2 Timothy, both Titus and Tychicus were serving in other areas. So we suspect that it was probably Artemis that was sent to relieve Titus in Crete. Then there's the bit about Zenas and Apollos, right? Zenas we know absolutely nothing about other than this one mention. Apollos we know a little bit about from Acts and from 1 Corinthians. And they were passing through Crete. We presume that they were the ones carrying Paul's letter, that they showed up with this letter for Titus. And we also presume that they were probably headed for Alexandria. We know that's where Apollos was from. And Crete would be right on a straight line from where Paul was to Alexandria. And Paul just wants them treated with respect. When he says, you know, do everything you can to speed them on their way, that means host them. Take them in, meet their needs, take care of them, make sure that they're well taken care of. And it probably means that when they leave, send them with money, right? Help them on their way. Make sure that they have what they need to continue on their journey. So other than that, the first thing that Paul deals with in this section is the heretics. Isn't it fun to say the word heretic? Go ahead and say it.
Heretics.
Right? It's Monty Python would have said that it was what was the word they used? Not a tinny word, but a, they would have sat around saying heretic, right? So The word Paul uses here is avoid, right? And literally in the Greek, it's like circumnavigate, right? It literally means to make a circle around. And depending on the form of the word, it can mean to surround, like an army would surround a city, or it can mean make a wide circle around something, to give something a wide berth. And that's what it means here. Paul's advice assumes that all of us, as we walk through life, will occasionally meet with foolish controversies, with arguments, and with quarrels, right? Those are going to be there from time to time. We don't get to choose not to bump into those. And Paul's desire is that rather just walking right into them unawares, that we see them up ahead of time and take 495 right out around them, right? There are a couple proverbs about this, in the Old Testament book of Proverbs. It says, the prudent see danger and take refuge or hide themselves. But the simple keep going and pay the penalty, right? Keep your eyes open. Don't walk into these things. Another proverb says, it is to one's honor to avoid strife, but every fool is quick to quarrel. Right? The honorable thing is to avoid strife. Now, a lot of us are the type that do that fairly naturally, right? There are a lot of people who are conflict avoidant, right? And often we kind of talk about that as though it's a character flaw. It's a character trait, right? And in different situations, that character trait can be negative or positive. And there are a lot of situations where being conflict avoidant is actually a really good and wise thing. So there are a lot of us that are the type that do that naturally, but there are also lots of us for whom this takes a lot of restraint, right? And sometimes that's because we're the type that's just really drawn to controversy, right? There are people who just love a good fight. But there's also another type that doesn't like to fight. They're just the kind of person that just assumes that all the other person needs is a really good explanation. And hey, I can do that, right? And that person often keeps going and pays the penalty, right? And Paul says here that we don't need to fight every battle. That every wrong point of view is not something that has to be engaged and corrected. And I think that's really, really important. Right? Especially, I mean, this is touching on so many conversations that are going on right now, right? Because we are so surrounded by points of view that we don't agree with, right? We do not have to fight every single one of those battles. But here, Paul isn't necessarily talking in the first place about disagreements with those out there. Right? Specifically, he's talking about the disagreements that pop up right in our midst. Right? The term here, when he says a divisive person, literally in the Greek, that's the word from which we get the word heretic. Okay? Now, the word heretic has a ton of baggage, okay? So that it really no longer means what it originally meant. Right? Because when we think heretic, most people's associations are the Middle Ages and burning people at the stake and, you know, denunciations and some sort of orthodoxy that just is rigid and is ready to kill people for disagreeing. Right? And that has nothing to do with New Testament times. The word heretic originally simply means one who chooses to think differently. Okay? The word heretic actually comes from the word choice. Okay? Interestingly, nowadays, one who chooses to think differently sounds commendable. Right? We respect that person that doesn't just jump on the bandwagon, that just doesn't think what everybody else thinks. Sheeple, wake up! Right? But in context, Paul's referring to a person who disagrees with the whole church about the fundamentals of following Jesus. Okay? Now, the NIV makes it look like Paul's first concern is that we warn this person twice. Right? The NIV takes that phrase and sets it up as a separate sentence. Warn the person. If they don't listen to you, warn them again. In the original, it's not actually like that. That's another one of these participial phrases that just modifies something else. Okay? The original is slightly different. The original is assuming that an attempt has been made once or twice to correct the person by drawing their attention to the fact that nobody else agrees with them. Right? But then the only command that Paul actually makes here, he says, after you've talked with them once or twice, you know, that's the part that he's not commanding, he's just assuming. And then the part that he commands then is, if that doesn't work, have nothing to do with them. That's what really is on Paul's mind. He's not telling us how to deal with disagreements. Well, he is. But it's after the disagreement has happened, what he's really saying is, back away from them. Okay? The word behind the phrase, have nothing to do with, means refuse to engage. Okay? Just kind of interestingly here, one of the times it shows up in secular Greek literature, there was a wrestler who was declared victor without even fighting, because when he took his shirt off, none of the other wrestlers were going to get anywhere near him. Right? They all just backed away. They refused to engage. Okay? And I like that example, not only because it just kind of reaches back into the Greek world a little bit, because it highlights, totally accidentally, one of the reasons why I think sometimes we have a hard time refusing to engage the person who's got something wrong, right? What happened in that little example about the wrestlers? No one engaged him, and he was declared victor. And that galls us. We're afraid that the person who's wrong might come off looking like the victor. It can be hard to keep quiet when falsehoods go unchallenged. But that's not Paul's concern here. Paul's warning us that there are situations, and they are not uncommon, when the divisive person benefits from having the argument, no matter how it goes. It doesn't matter if you succeed in demonstrating how ridiculous their position are. Simply engaging in the argument, they win. When it has been communicated to someone that the church is not in agreement with them and they don't care, there's just no point in engaging it further. Now, in a minute, we're going to go on to verse 14. And contrast what we see there with what Paul is talking about here. But first, I'd like to pause and just think a little bit about this refuse to engage. We don't go around calling people heretics anymore, right? Mostly because, as I said, the word has picked up so much other baggage, other meanings and associations since Paul's time. But we deal with this all the time. Okay? And by heresy, I don't mean necessarily the big questions of unorthodox Christology or something, right? I mean just simply people choosing to think differently than the rest of the church about things that actually matter, right? This doesn't have to do with the color of the pews or anything. So as I said, the word heretic comes from the word choice. And you know what? God has made it that people are absolutely free to think as they wish and do as they wish. You know, and sometimes we don't like that, but I think that is actually really, really, really fundamental. It's one of the points I make in that Joining God's Mission series that we're going to be coming up on, that God did not make a world where people have to think what he thinks. God did not make a world where people have to see him for who he is, and therefore have to love him for who he is, and therefore have to obey him for who he is. God chose to create a world where people are free to agree with him and disagree with him. Not because he wants people to disagree with him to their own eternal loss, but because he wants people to choose to love him. People are free to think as they wish and do as they wish by God's design. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean unlimited free will. You can't choose to be a fish, right? But within the bounds of what God has allowed, you do have freedom. And since the very first time the gospel was ever preached, there have been people who have chosen to understand it their own way. That is their right. But when the whole church, and you can think in two different directions here when I say the whole church, you can think both the universal, right, the whole church throughout history, throughout the world, and you can think the congregation, when the whole church, us here assembled together, right, when the whole church hears a person out and then responds in a united voice, that is not what we believe. That person then has a choice. They can humble themselves, not before their idiot brothers and sisters who don't understand a thing, but before the church, and think, maybe I have something to learn here. Or they can insist that they are right and everyone else is wrong. And that is their right. But in that case, they have to accept that if they persist in holding a view that everyone else rejects, they themselves are choosing to step outside of what makes us us. Originally, that's all the word heretic means. It's not a condemnation. It's a recognition that you've stepped across the line. You are no longer where we are. And we didn't excommunicate you, right? You chose. Heresy, choice. Okay? And the fact that they themselves choose to step outside of what makes us us means that they are no longer in the former relationship. They have set themselves in a new relationship to the rest of the church. Now, that doesn't mean that we judge them. It doesn't mean that we try to make things worse for them. It doesn't mean that we try to pray down discipline on them, although sometimes there is a place for that, but that has to be done very, very carefully, right? They still, as ever before, stand before God, and they are 100% his business. And a side note, we keep in mind that God is very merciful, very patient, and very creative in finding ways to restore people. But the recognition that they have put themselves into a new relationship means that we have nothing to do with them, at least in terms of the prior relationship. Which means that to have nothing to do with them doesn't necessarily mean to shun them, or to cross the street when you see them coming down the sidewalk, or to hide as though you're looking at the pasta very, very intently when you see them at Shaw's, right? I'm just so absorbed in the nutritional facts here that I just didn't see you, right? None of that has anything spiritual to do with it. That's just our own insecurity of, oh, how do I deal with this person now? Because the relationship has changed, right? And that's not what Paul's talking about. Because we always have multiple relationships. That person that priorly was a brother or sister in the church may still be your neighbor. And that neighborly relationship has certain roles and responsibilities and norms, even if the other relationship has changed. Someone that you have nothing to do with, you may still have a very pleasant neighborly conversation with. But it's not going to be the kind of conversation that you used to have. Right? Because the basis or the nature of the relationship has changed. An estranged family member is still a family member. But the estrangement makes it so that there's no actual experience of that family relationship. Okay? So then, after dealing here with the heretics, and then the notes about the people coming and going, and Artemis and Tychicus and Zenas and Apollos and stuff, Paul then briefly repeats what I think has been his core concern all throughout this letter. Verse 14 says, our people must learn to devote themselves to doing what is good in order that they may provide for daily necessities and not live unproductive lives. Now think for just a minute just how that sentence is structured, right? First, Paul says the main idea. Our people have to learn them to devote themselves to doing what's good. And then you have a purpose clause. In order that, and the purpose clause has two ideas, right? Provide for daily necessities and not live unproductive ideas. Now again, forgive me for all the time getting picky with the NIV, but this makes it sound like we do good in order to meet our own physical needs. Okay? And that's really not what the original wording does. Okay? In the original wording, there are two different purpose clauses that are phrased in different ways, so they're very separate from each other. Okay? Here's my attempt to capture what's going on a little bit more closely. Let our people learn to devote themselves to good works aimed at meeting needs in order that they would not be unfruitful. There are different ways to indicate purpose in Greek, and the real clear in order that kind of purpose driving this is what I'm concerned about. The only thing that follows that, the only thing in that clause is that we would not be unfruitful. And the other way of phrasing purpose, the one that's not as important, is the bit about meeting needs. And it relates directly to the nature of the good works. The good works themselves meet needs, and we devote ourselves to those good works that meet needs in order that our lives would not be unfruitful. Okay? The meeting of needs is a description of the act of doing good work. It's not the purpose. It's a description of the good works. The larger purpose is bearing fruit for God as branches of the vine. Now, we spoke about this the other week, right? This was the burden of the letter for the last 2 weeks. But notice here again that God's people are to devote themselves to good works. This is not, as I said last week, just simply be ready, right? This is go find them. Wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'm breathing still. There must be good works for me to go do, right? I dare say that for most of us, this ought to occupy a larger part of our life aspirations. I'm speaking for myself here, okay? It's not that I'm against good works, right? No, I'm all totally for it. But how much of my attention does it really grab? We like to do good. We approve of doing good. We're delighted when doing good fits into our schedule in a way that we think we can handle. But does it occupy enough of our concern to justify the word devoted? Now, I am not going to say that going out into the world to do good work that benefits people around us in concrete ways is the heart of the gospel. I'm not saying that. I won't set devotion to good works that benefit people in concrete ways alongside of repentance of sin, faith in Christ, transforming power of the Holy Spirit as we're born again from above. Okay? To say it in a metaphorical way, Romans is a much bigger book than Titus. Okay? But the call to honor God by going out into the world to live good lives that actually benefit the people around us, whether they love us or hate us, is maybe not the heart of the gospel, but it is the heart of the message of the book of Titus. And Titus, I'm not going to set it side by side with Romans, but Titus made it into the New Testament. And so I urge each one of you, I urge myself, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, to consciously, prayerfully, with purpose, expecting some kind of answer, to consider how do I devote myself to good works that actually meet the needs of people. that's going to bear fruit. That's going to bring the life of the vine into the world around us. Now, this does not mean do more, do more, do more, sign up, right? Brace yourselves, the sign-up sheets are coming. No, for many of us, this may simply mean do what you do differently. But at the same time, it may be more than just do what you already do differently. I know it means that much. And for some of us, it might mean pushing out into some new territory and doing some new things. So having seen what Paul tells us to circle wide away from and what he tells us to devote ourselves to, I want to hold those two things up against each other. These two pictures. The picture that Paul says, don't do this, right? And the picture that he says, do this. I want to look at those two. Because letting some of the exact details go, right, getting a little bit stepping back from the real context, and then looking at them both in a more general sense, I think they represent two different responses that we see when the church encounters the world around us. I know that Paul was writing about disagreements within the church, but I think some of the same impulses drive a posture that the church sometimes takes towards the world. The world around us does not see life the way that we see it. Have you noticed? They hold utterly different assumptions or first principles. And so naturally, holding totally different assumptions about what life is for and what makes life good, holding totally different assumptions, naturally they come to utterly different conclusions about everything. Okay? And for many Christians, this is extremely upsetting. Just because anything that makes us uncomfortable is always upsetting. But also because many people are accustomed to a culture that gave at least lip service to a Christian worldview. That is gone. You know that. It probably weighs you down, makes you not want to leave your house in the morning or turn on the news. And the number one thing I want to say about that is, be of good cheer. When you look through history, the church has almost never been regarded as the moral authority. That thing that we think as we have been lost was a brief blip. The church has almost always lived as an out of step, misunderstood, suspected minority. Even during the so-called Christian ages of Europe, the majority of Christians worldwide lived as a suspect and discriminated against minority under Muslim empires in the East. The unsettling, strange world we find ourselves in, where we are the presumed bad guys, this is the native soil of Christianity. This is the norm. This is where the gospel thrives. This is Paul's world. So what do we do? How do we express our faith in a world that is frequently hostile before we've had a chance to say anything? One impulse is to argue. We sincerely believe that we are right about basic things. We believe that we have the truth and the truth has set us free. The truth about what our purpose is as humans. The truth about what life is really about. The truth about what makes a person fulfilled and satisfied. The truth about what is the real path forward. The truth about the most basic, what is the most basic problem in the world and what needs to be done about it. Right? We have deep convictions about these things. And all day long we hear other views, which we can frequently just see the plain contradictions in those views. And sometimes the falsehood is glaring. And it can be so tempting to stand up and argue, to expose the inconsistencies, to highlight the ironies, to demonstrate the hypocrisies. Except that we're told over and over, starting with Jesus himself, that the world can't hear us, that the world will not accept us because these things are discerned spiritually. And without the grace of God working in people's hearts, we are simply arguing with a blind person about what shade of blue the wall is. Notice, not what shade it should be, just what it is. So then, how do we express our faith in a world that is frequently hostile? Let our people devote themselves to doing good in the meeting of needs. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Can you imagine if this is what we were famous for? Can you imagine if everyone who called themselves Christian, and I choose that wording closely because, you know what, when you really get down to it, the reputation of Christians is being set by people who are not Christians. I think some of them are and are misled. I think a lot of them simply just are not Christians. Anytime you hear the word Christians or evangelicals used in a news source, the data that they're using for all of that is taken from surveys, and in surveys, evangelical Christian is a self-defined point of view. There is no criteria for what that term means. A very famous Southern Baptist ethicist did research into this. The vast majority of people who identify themselves as evangelical Christians on like political surveys and stuff, the vast majority of them do not attend church, do not read the Bible, do not hold the faith positions that we believe are central to what it means to be an evangelical Christian. Okay? So first of all, this whole thing of out there in the world of what people think an evangelical Christian says, it has nothing to do with us! But can you imagine if everyone who called themselves Christian stopped arguing and started serving, started devoting themselves to meeting the needs that are all around us? Can you imagine if the church got back to its roots and got serious about meeting and engaging poverty, engaging addiction, engaging homelessness, engaging the neglect of people, whether it's because they're old or they're young or they're special needs or whatever it is? And when I say that, some of you might think, but then who would stand up for the truth? Well, you know what? I expect that if Christians devoted themselves to doing good, there would start to be a lot more quiet conversations with people coming up to ask us, what in the world is it that you actually believe? Because Christians, they're everywhere spoken against, but there's something different about you.